call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. Welcome, everyone. We have a single very meaty issue on our agenda today for public hearing, so I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 326.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 326 deals with the issue that we've been working on in the interim, which is a reform of inheritance tax, or what you call the estate tax. The Senate Bill 326 is an identical bill to a bill that we've introduced also through the House Revenue Committee, and we're basically looking at the same amendments, the same shape of the bill, in order to be able to bring the two committees in the same frame of time and kind of reference of where we are and how this committee would get those proposals through this session. The Oregon Law Commission has taken this task, light, very delightful task, of reforming the inheritance tax, since we've tried to do a few things to it. In the last couple sessions, starting with the 2007 session, and it seems because we had all this connection and in and out with the federal law, it seems like every time we've touched that code and that tax, we kind of made things a little more twisted at the ends. So we needed expert help and type of people to be able to look at this, untangle all the strands that we kind of put together without necessarily wanting to, and bring some kind of format and legal language and legal structure that will maintain the policies that you've approved since the 2007 and you wanted to go to, while maintaining a legal structure and legal language that actually accomplishes that without making things worse. So this is the towards almost the, you'll be receiving the end of these reports that we, that the Oregon Law Commission has been working with. Lane Shirley, the chair of the commission, with Wendy Johnson, the general counsel of the commission, today will be giving you the kind of almost the final product of what they've been working with, a very extensive and selfless group of people who they made as a task force that have been working very diligently in putting this together.
Okay, Lane Shetterly and Wendy Johnson. Welcome. Lane, normally when people leave the legislature, they don't have to work on these issues quite as hard. So do you ever wonder what where you went astray on this?
Yeah, never could say goodbye. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lane Shetterly here in my capacity today as chair of the Oregon Law Commission and chair of the Inheritance Tax Law Reform Project. And as Mazen told you, and I should say I'm joined by Wendy Johnson. Wendy is Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Law Commission and has been staffing this project. As Mazen told you, we have spent about the last 20 months or so looking at the rewrite of the Oregon inheritance tax as you requested, with a couple of provisos in that review, chief among them that we strive for substantially revenue neutral change in the inheritance tax. I think, as I said early in this project, if the legislature wanted to abolish the inheritance tax, you don't need a work group to do that. You just pass the bill. If you wanted just to raise rates, you don't need a work group to do that. You just pass the bill. But in restructuring the inheritance tax, it's a multifaceted effort with lots of tendrils and moving parts. And we have endeavored, as we've gone through this, to maintain that objective of keeping this substantially revenue neutral and providing you with a state inheritance tax system that will work and will work much, much better than the current system that we have. Just as I gave you the background, and you've heard it before, but for the information of the folks in the room and maybe listening, I'll just review this briefly, that we were doing really well in Oregon with our pickup tax, where what we collected in state in inheritance tax of the state was really just a function of the federal estate tax up until the 2001 Tax Reconciliation Act, which divorced that system from what we had in the states. Oregon elected, as some states did, but not all, to continue to collect a state inheritance tax. And we've continued to do that with our tax tied not to any particular rate schedule, but tied to the old credit, whatever the feds would have allowed under as a credit under the pre-2001 laws. We have adopted that basically as the basis for our tax. The farther away we get from in time from that, the harder it is for the public, for practitioners, to manage that. It's a tenuous relationship between our tax and that basis of the tax being the pre-2001 federal law. And so we are proposing in this to really create a new comprehensive state inheritance tax that will still be tied to the federal tax for many purposes, but will still be a state tax. In context, and I've passed out, or you have distributed here just a few things. One is a report, and I'll kind of walk through that as I give my testimony. And in addition to that, you've got some charts and graphs. If you take a look at the fourth page of that collection, it's the 50 states approaches to taxation of property at death. You will see the variety of approaches that states have taken since the federal law changed in 2001. The number of states that have no state-imposed estate or inheritance tax being 28. So the majority of states opted not to implement their own estate or inheritance tax. And then you have quite a range of estate taxes among the states, the range being at what level they tax. Oregon, as you can see, is in that group of states that provides $1 million exemption to our estates, being kind of in the middle of the pack with the exemptions going all the way down to $338,000 in Ohio and up to $5 million in North Carolina. So there really is a broad variety in the way states have adopted. Something else that's not evident in this chart that I think is important for context, and then I'll get into talking about the proposal itself, is that we and Washington are the only two Western states that have an inheritance or a state tax. California doesn't, Alaska doesn't, Idaho, Nevada, Utah, none of our neighboring Western states have this tax. And so in looking around the neighborhood, there's not too many neighbors to look at. Washington is the only one that we look at, and we did look at in terms of structuring our proposal. One of the issues that we have we thought well, let me just on key facts is on page 2 of the report, just a couple of facts about the fun facts about inheritance tax. It's about a $200 million per biennium source of revenue, so it's not huge in the scheme of things, but it's enough that you'd miss it if it was gone. About 1,000 inheritance tax returns are filed each year. The last bullet on that page really sets the stage for talking about the proposal, and that is this, that we have this $1 million exemption, as I described. But once you reach that $1 million and you go over that million, you actually pay tax back to the first dollar of the estate. So you start at about the is that 41% marginal? Is that right? But anyway, the dollar amount of that first dollar over a million, the tax liability goes from zero to about $33,000 based on that difference between no tax and then that first dollar of a taxable estate, because the tax liability really is imposed, once it's imposed, back to the first dollar in value. We thought that was a little bit dramatic, and our proposing a change as part of the structure, and that is that we would begin to tax really above that threshold. So it really would be a true exclusion for the first part of the estate, and then like the federal estate tax, we would begin to tax above that, and so you would have a ramp instead of a big step at that first dollar. In talking about that, and that's just a structural issue and one that we think as a work group makes sense, we were also concerned that we have practitioners in the work group that do practice in the Portland area and are very sensitive to the difference between Oregon and Washington, where Oregon has $1 million exemption amount and Washington a $2 million exemption, and that at least anecdotally what we heard in the task force is that it is not an unheard of estate tax strategy to recommend to a married couple that if they move across the river they can knock $2 million off of their taxable estate because of the exemption amount between the two spouses and the difference between the states. And so we are concerned that there is a potentially at least a competitive disadvantage, keeping in mind there's no point even comparing us to California or any of the other states around us because they don't have it. But to the state that does, Washington, that $1 million difference in exemption amounts seemed significant. So we looked at a couple of structures, and they are on the sheet that you were looking at that has the 50 state approaches to taxation. Behind that are three charts that look like this. Sorry for the low tech. This is kind of really, you can compare dark gray with black as you're looking at this chart. But I'll go through this quickly, but what we've done here, again, looking at Washington and using that as being at least something to compare ourselves with. If we, assuming that we want a revenue-neutral structure here in Oregon, if we maintain our exemption amount at $1 million and then ramp it so that instead of that big step, it starts small and grows, this is what the structure would look like. The bars on the left of each set represents the Oregon tax, and the dark bars to the right on each set represent the Washington tax. That's the million. And again, our concern about the million was just that its competitive relationship with the state of Washington at $2 million. So we said, what if you go at $1.5 million? That is, we raise the exemption amount to $1.5 million and we still maintain revenue neutrality. Based on the figures that we had available. And that is the next chart. It has a 2 at the bottom of it. And that shows that we start really at $1.5 million, and then we have that same ramp. If you notice up at the boxes up at the top, you have a number under Oregon inheritance tax that begins with a percentage in the right-hand column, 8.6. That compares with 8.5 in the next box, which is the Washington box. And then that represents the rates, and it gets down to at $15,100,000. Oregon is at 19.2. Washington is at 19. We thought that looked pretty good. Those rates match fairly well along the way with Washington. Because obviously, if you're going to be exempting another $500,000 off of each estate to move that exemption amount to $1.5 million, and you're going to be maintaining revenue neutrality, you have to make that up on the upper end of estates, because they're going to have to pay more to exempt those estates up to $1.5 million. Concerned about that, we wanted to make sure that if we did that at the top end, that we maintained, again, a competitive posture relative to Washington, and this $1.5 million exemption and the ramp really seems to accomplish that fairly well. The next chart, just briefly, we thought, well, what happens if we really jump and we go to a $2 million exemption, same as Washington? You can see there that the rates get substantially out of line with Washington, where we go at at $6 million, we're 5.1, we're at 20.5%, as opposed to 16.1% in Washington, and we top out at 24.2 as opposed to 19. We thought that was probably too dramatic a change. And so in our structure, probably the first policy choice that we made and that you're going to have to address, as we have structured the inheritance tax with a $1.5 million exemption, revenue neutral, that will begin with that ramp as opposed to the big step when you get that first dollar over the $1.5 million. So that's the first choice, and we made that because we thought, again, it's more competitive relative to our sister state, both in terms of the exemption amount and also does not get us out of too far out of line with where they are at the top end.
Senator Telfer.
Thank you. Because this does mirror Washington's estate tax law very closely, when you talk about revenue neutrality, have you considered in that neutrality the fact that we may lose residents to Washington or another state?
Yeah.
So that you're in essence losing revenue?
Well, the effect would be just the opposite, wouldn't it?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Telford, yeah, nobody has the numbers, and so we can't model it. Anecdotally, we did hear that, you know, that's advice given. If you accept that, then you may be actually retaining taxpayers with this that otherwise now might be moving over to Washington because we're closing the gap, closing the difference between the two states.
A follow-up, but there's still a gap.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, there is still a gap. Yeah, we've closed the gap from $1 million to a $500,000 gap per estate.
Right.
And again, it was primarily the focus on revenue neutrality and the impact that it would have on the upper ends that really mitigated in our work group against going to the full $2 million exemption. That would be a dramatic increase in the mid to larger estates that we thought would be even more difficult than what you're looking at probably on the $1.5 million. On that, if you look at that just briefly on the chart, that's the $1.5 million, it's the one that says 2 at the bottom of it. It's only coincidental, but it's a happy coincidence that if you'll note, under that structure at $5 million, if you look at the number at the bottom of the page, or 5-1, that's about the break-even point.
It's page two.
That's about where Oregon estates would start to pay more.
That happens to correspond to
changes in the federal estate tax, where $5 million is now the threshold under the federal law, and states that pay federal tax do get a deduction for state taxes paid. So the feds would actually be helping to pay for that extra tax liability for those states above that $5 million. That's just kind of a happy coincidence. But that's the structure that we took. So an exemption amount of 1.5 and then a ramp from there. Revenue neutrality achieved by increasing the rates on the top end, as shown in the chart. But what we're doing there is exempting that many more estates and lowering the tax liability on estates at the low end.
Can you hear me for a second?
Yes, Wendy.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director from the Oregon Law Commission. Just to clarify, we didn't choose the 1.5 only because it would be more competitive with Washington. We really looked at policy reasons of increasing it. It is one of the lower thresholds. And if you look at the first, or the second and third pages of the chart packet, you'll see that there are so many estates that do fall between that 1 and 1.5 million that cause a lot of work for the Department of Revenue. And they also are often the ones in the natural resource credit area, and there's no auditing that's being done on those very easily because they don't fall within the federal threshold. So there is no federal estate tax. So it's hard to keep to really enforce those taxes, those estates anyway. So there were a lot of other reasons why we wanted to raise that threshold from $1 million to $1.5 million. for estates, not only the Washington reason. And that's because I know this committee often talks about how our whole tax structure is different than Washington, so we can't just look at it in isolation. So you should know that there were other policy reasons to choose the 1.5 other than just to be more competitive.
And on balance, by doing that, by the two decisions to raise the threshold and to create the ramp, you are, by definition, making it more progressive.
Yes.
Aren't you? Yeah. And also, you know, it's hard to, it makes sense in a way that, you know, someone might move to Washington to have a liquidity event, given our tax structure. But having people go to Washington to die? Sounds a little iffy. Did you get much anecdotal testimony on that?
Madam Chair, yes, we did get anecdotal, and again, no numbers. But I'm not sure that's so iffy.
Madam Chair,
Senator Morris,
you go there to live.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Because you can't afford to live here or die here.
But if you're not in Oregon, in my opinion, you're not living. So.
Way down the income threshold, people come to Oregon to die. Most of those people don't have to deal with it.
The problem, Madam Chair, that all the witnesses were gone by the time.
That's right. And I should say, Madam Chair, that the meeting that we did have with candles in the dark room, it didn't work.
We will have to get a committee Ouija board to proceed with this issue.
So, Madam Chair, lots of reasons, but you know, I just want that really is a central feature of the bill that we need to highlight because it does implicate a policy decision. Lots of what we did was technical. Fixing the estate tax, the Oregon estate tax, is sort of like cleaning out that closet in the house you've lived in for 30 years. You look at things and you say, I didn't know we still had that. And we've done a lot of that. But most of that is very technical, and it's important, but it's not going to raise policy issues. This will. I'll speed through the rest of this because I know there are other folks who want to testify, and I'll be happy to answer questions as we go and when we're done. But something else that we did is build in, I should say, the terminology. I'll start using it, estate tax. It really is an estate tax. An inheritance tax, by common definition, is something that the beneficiaries pay when they receive the property. They owe the tax. An estate tax is something that the estate pays before the distribution is made to the beneficiaries. That's what we have.
What's the difference? I mean, why do people do it differently, and what are the implications of that?
Madam Chair, I don't know. It has been so long since we've actually had an inheritance tax. Mm-hmm. I would venture to guess, probably, that most, certainly the federal government and states went to an estate tax because you've got one taxpayer rather than any number of taxpayers who receive distributions. And I think in terms of administration and collection, it's a much easier system to administer as an estate tax than
but
as
we didn't
an
really contemplate changing the structure then.
No. No, what we've done is just change the nomenclature because it is an estate tax, and so you'll see that in the bill. We're calling it an estate tax because that's what it is. The other thing, and we've approached it so that we'll have something that's really very similar in structure to the income tax code. That is, we'll have our own rates and we'll have our own natural resource tax credit and marital provisions related to marital property. We'll have our own pieces of this, but for definitional purposes and for a lot of the detail, we'll connect to the federal estate tax law so that we don't need to define what is a gross estate or those kinds of things. We'll connect to federal law, and we're going to update that connection to December of 2010 so that we are current. And then, just like the inheritance income tax, periodically the legislature can connect or not connect to changes in the federal estate tax and stay current that way. But those connections are really primarily for definitional purposes. The rates and what you pay is all going to be found and defined in the Oregon tax statutes.
Lane, if we did take that approach of connecting to the federal, what impact on us would it be if the feds lowered or raised the threshold?
Madam Chair, good question. That's one area we're not connecting. That's where we're saying we're at $1.5 million. And we're not connecting to that because right now the federal exemption amount is $5 million.
Right.
And also, so they could change that and it wouldn't affect.
Okay. And the same goes for their rates?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah, right. Madam Chair, we will have our own threshold. We'll have our own rate schedule, and that'll actually be in the ORS. So that will be ours. That will belong to us. It's primarily for definitional issues that we would connect to the federal estate tax.
If the feds ever did get rid of it altogether, then we'd just have to regroup and...
Madam Chair, that'd be probably very similar to what happened when the feds passed EGTRA in 2001. At that point, maybe on a short-term basis, we might stay connected to the expired federal law until we build our own that carries, that brings in all of those other elements that we don't have to recreate right now. But yeah, there'd be ways to do that, and ours would not go away. You would still be connected to the last date that the state law connected at any time that the federal estate tax might go away. Just going through this, a couple points on marital property. We've clarified issues around marital property, and this becomes complicated, and I won't say any more about it than that, just because of the difference in exemption amounts that we have in Oregon at 1.5 and the federal $5 million exemption. So elections that you might make for federal law really are not going to be that applicable to Oregon because you'll have so many estates in Oregon that will have Oregon tax but won't owe federal tax. And so you won't be making those elections under the federal tax. You will under Oregon. And we've been very clear about stating how Oregon's marital property elections and provisions apply separate from but coordinated with the federal. I'll come back to the natural resource property at the last. I'll just touch on that because I think it's really just about the last thing I want to comment on. We do retain the natural resource tax credit in this. We've done quite a bit of cleanup on it. Again, most of it being technical. One of the things that we have done, and I know we talked about it in an interim committee, I know the legislature struggled with this concept of working capital and how to incorporate that in the natural resources tax credit. And we struggled with that too, and really ultimately found it unworkable to create a some sort of a formula for working capital, given that working capital is going to be so different from estate to estate, from natural resource type property to natural resource type property, even from crop to crop, what may be growing, and even and also in the cycle of in the growth of crop. And when a person dies, all of those things would have an impact on how you might calculate working capital using history or some records. In lieu of that, what we have adopted is a 20% standard that says that you can use 20% of cash and cash equivalents to qualify as operating capital, as operating allowance. So that is 20% of the other natural resource property. So that you can use cash and you can use cash equivalents to qualify as part of the natural resource tax credit, recognizing that an arbitrary amount, but we thought it was acceptable around the table as being probably a good surrogate for working capital that would apply across the board. Understanding that along with that 20% election that you may make for cash or cash equivalents as natural resource property, that also then becomes subject to all of the limitations on use and disposition that natural resource property is subject to. So we think that there's a good a way to discourage abuse of that. Once that goes in, that has to be maintained as available for use in the natural resource property for 5 of the next 8 years, basically. So you can't just shelter cash, call it natural resource property, and then distribute it out to the beneficiaries. If you're going to call it natural resource property as an operating allowance, it has to stay within the operation. And so it's going to mitigate against a cavalier use of that because of the limitations that we put on being able to transfer that out. we're in the process. We want to maintain revenue neutrality in that gross sense in the bill. We also want to maintain revenue neutrality in the natural resource credit, so we don't expand it, we don't contract it beyond a standard deviation or something like that, because this is awfully difficult to be precise in. And there, we're working on a formula. We had about an hour and a half long telephone conversation with Mazin this morning, working on just the formula that's going to do that, and we're very close to it. But the concept of it will be that we will retain the natural resource tax credit, the natural resource property tax credit. We have made some technical adjustments to it, and we will have it for you in such a way that it is substantially revenue neutral as a share of the total Oregon estate tax. Like the estate tax, generally it may not be the same for every estate as it would have been under old law, but in the gross sense, it will be roughly, I should say, substantially revenue neutral. I'm talking a lot. I think I'll just about quit. Wendy, is there any, are there any major issues that I haven't touched on that that we should? Madam Chair, I'll just say that I've talked to you before during the interim, but the work group you've got here has been a phenomenal group of people, practitioners, tax and estate planning attorneys and accountants tax interested people who are interested in tax policy in the state, a lot of brain power around the table, and it's been hard for me to keep up often. But these folks have been committed to it, and I'm really pleased with the work that they've done. They will be offering you some policy choices that you'll have to make, chief among them probably the structure of it with the ramp and the 1.5. But in the big picture, you know, if you decide that, no, we don't want to go to 1.5, we want to leave it at a million, it still will be a structure that you can use, and you can adjust to make the numbers work. We think there's good reason, as Wendy said, for lots of reasons, to go to the 1.5 million, you know, but ultimately to be your call. But it's been a great work group to work with. I'm very impressed with the time and energy that they've put in. There's a lot of billable hours been invested in this project that we haven't billed for, and I hope that the work of the group will be favorably received by the committees when we have a chance to present it in final iteration.
Well, and we want to express our deep appreciation for the work that you've done. It's one of our real flashes of brilliance last session was putting this project into your able hands, so really appreciate
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All that you've done, and I will not accept the premise that they're that you're having a hard time keeping up with them.
Okay. Thank you.
I know you too well. Anyway, thank you very much. Are there questions before Senator Morris?
I did. Thank you, Madam Chair, and again, gratitude for all the hard work. I see that compliance and auditing did come to your attention, and I'm wondering, did you do any benchmarking or come to any conclusions with respect to how we compare with other states? And maybe elaborate a little bit on,
sure,
on how you come to it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, we did look at that, and no benchmarking. This is a really hard area to understand, especially where you know, even, of course, now the federal exemption is at $5 million, up to until last year it was $3.5 million. So for several years, you've had a gap between the states that have had, been required to file federal and states that have been required to file the state inheritance tax. It used to be easy. If you filed the federal estate tax return, it was just like the income tax, you know, there was a correspondence there, and the state would know that the return is filed. You could pick that up. We don't know what we don't know is basically what it comes down to. And Deborah Buchanan is here from the department, and I know that she was conversant in that. But we don't know what we don't know. We don't know who's not filing. Because short of, well, let me in the old days, when you probated an estate, before you could close the estate and distribute, you had to get a note from the Department of Revenue that said the inheritance tax had been paid, and you had to file that with the court in order to distribute the estate. That was one way the state in those days kept track. Now you have so many estates, especially with the growth of trusts and other alternative planning vehicles, where that just wouldn't be effective to capture the majority of estates. I think Deborah has said that things that they do and can do are as varied as reading the death notices in the newspaper and
income tax.
That's right, income tax. When a person dies and they file a final income tax return, that has to be noted on the income tax return, and that can trigger a look to see. And that would continue under this. We think that we probably will have a better rate of compliance, especially if we go with the 1.5. That's going to tend to be more sophisticated estates and estate planning, which means in this case that you're going to have accountants and attorneys who are going to be cognizant of the filing requirement to help their clients comply, more so than you do at the lower end probably of estates that we may be missing. So we think we might actually improve compliance in that way and capture more of the estates that actually have tax to pay. And there is one piece in the compliance in the natural resource tax credit that we're strengthening, and that is that when you've claimed a natural resource tax credit, we're going to require under this bill that you file an annual report with the Department of Revenue to show basically what's on hand, so that if there's been a disposition during the year, then the department will know that. They don't have any way to know that now. If you've claimed natural resource tax credit, but then you just sell off the farm in 2 years, unless a neighboring farmer or somebody who has an interest in it happens to pick up the phone and call, nobody will know that. Now we've structured it so that estates that claim that natural resource tax credit will have to file an annual information report just to show what's on hand, so any dispositions would be picked up. That's kind of what we did. The other thing, what the department would say right now that they're hampered, I think, in this area as in so many others in terms of manpower, the number of people that they have to do this. And they're very short on that. And so you could always, apart from this bill, increase compliance by adding the number of staff to the inheritance tax or estate tax section. But that's other than an observation, we haven't addressed that specifically in this bill.
Madam Chair, if I might ask one of our colleagues who is a CPA, what requirements exist for CPAs to, when there is a known tax liability, to make sure that it is, in fact, paid?
Oh, we don't have to ensure it gets paid. We have to notify our clients that they owe and that it needs to be paid, but we don't have to ensure that it gets paid. It's not up to us to do that.
You don't have special CPA six shooters to enforce.
Nope.
That could be another strategy.
You know, I could cancel payment on the check after we put the stamp on it, mailed it. I mean, you know, it would be pretty difficult to lay that burden on us. But I guess, if I may, since the door has been opened, you referred to the, you know, increasing it to $1.5 million, and obviously you're going to be dealing with a lot more people who have now financial planners, CPAs, right, and things. And, you know, we do a lot of estate planning, and our biggest concern is stop changing the rules because, you know, some of these things are pretty well set. But in trying to, I would not want to see the department start fishing trips, to go on fishing trips because they happen to see deceased on a Form 40 or something like that, because, you know, a lot of us do a good job for our clients, and to have to all of a sudden, you know, we've got trust set up and things like that, and then all of a sudden have to answer to a bunch of inquiries by the department because they're on a fishing trip is not something I would want to see happening.
Madam Chair and Senator Telfer, and I understand it, and that's why I say we talked about that, and there's nothing in the bill about that. I was just in responding to Senator Morse's question that would be one way, I think, from having heard the department talk about this before, that they could do that. I don't think there's any plans for them to do that now. I don't think they have the staff to do it, but that was one way that they, I think, has said that they have done it in the past or could do it. But again, we're not making any special provision for that in this bill.
Thank you very much, and please stay in the room.
Thank you.
If you have the time.
I do.
Okay, I'll call Mark Stain. and Jeff Musgrove. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark Steen. I'm the executive director with the Oregon Funeral Directors Association, and I come today in support of this bill. Funeral homes are traditionally amongst the oldest and tend to be generational businesses in most communities. And so estate tax and these kind of things affect my members. I brought with me one of my members today who's going to talk more specific with you about it, but we're just here today to support the bill.
Thank you for coming. Welcome.
Hi, Chair Burdick, members of the panel. I am Jeff Musgrove. I'm a second-generation funeral director from Eugene, Oregon. My brother and I bought our funeral business from my parents in the 90s. My dad started working at our funeral home in 1950, and after 40 years, he and my mom packed it in, and my brother and I started buying the business from them. And at that time, they consulted an estate attorney and CPA, life insurance, and came up with seems to be, from what I understand, a sophisticated estate plan. Now he's 80 years old, and he's pays this life insurance policy, and he doesn't really understand what it's all about anymore. And I can't help him. And of course, in the ensuing time, my brother and I do estate planning, and we're trying to do what we can so that if in the event of the death of one of us, that our business, which was actually founded in 1883, doesn't have to be sold just to pay the estate taxes on it. And that's our wealth is just in our business. It's not that's anything that my parents had in their estate is in the business, and that's the way it is with my brother and I. It's just in our family business, and so it's a concern for us.
So you believe that the provisions of this bill, as you understand them, would help you in that effort to do
yes,
the
I
planning?
Yes, I do.
Okay, that's good. That's good to know, because this is the kind of family business that we want to keep intact in Oregon. Thank you. Okay, questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sean Cleave and Patrick Cooper. Capper.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sean Cleave, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. I don't want to belabor the technical aspects that Mr. Shetterly described in detail for the committee, but I will like to take this time to thank Mr. Shetterly and Ms. Johnson for their work and all the committee members that the time they spent over the summer drafting what is a very, very technical bill. I was pretty impressed with what otherwise I was somewhat skeptical of when the committee asked the Law Commission to take up the issue. I've been impressed with the work done so far, and of course, Farm Bureau's interest is in the natural resource tax credit. We have worked for the past 4 years now on refining the definitions and targeting those tax provisions towards what everybody would recognize as a farmer, which is something that's hard to define, especially in statute. So, again, I just like to convey my thanks for their work and the work of the committee and our support for the legislation.
Okay, and could you comment specifically on the switch from the capital equipment approach to the 20% set aside?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, that conversation was a multi-day conversation. It was an approach that was floated for discussion from the practitioners. We had prior to this bill, and our current statute actually provides a definition for how a farm would operate in its cash holdings for future investments or if a particular commodity was sold at the time of death, you would have lesser value in the real property because the crops counted under the natural resource credit and more of a cash holding. So how do you account for those bookkeeping practices in a state that is one of the most diverse in commodities and, you know, has a variety of different skill levels and for producers in Oregon? It's just a very difficult thing to define in statute because it's a moving target. The practitioners felt that the 20% qualification would be the equivalent of your average farm, and I think all things being equal, it's probably the best way to target that working capital number. 20% is reasonable from our perspective, and it's easier for the practitioners to calculate. So that's kind of a snapshot of what that discussion was over arriving at that modification.
Okay, thank you. That's good. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. I'm Patrick Happer with the Oregon Association of Nurseries. You have my written testimony, so I'll just touch on a couple points. The OAN believes that preserving family-owned nurseries is essential for the long-term viability of our industry, along with farm, forestry, and fishery operations. This bill encompasses a good faith solution to the problem of forcing natural resource industries to liquidate vital assets to pay an estate tax through the natural resources tax credit. I do want to commend the Oregon Law Commission for the hard work they did. They looked at the entirety of the tax code to determine revenue-sensitive solutions. Both the complexity and the state tax portion of the tax code and the revenue goal were daunting, and the Oregon Law Commission should be commended for the task and the work that they did. Refinement of the estate tax is a top priority for my members. We advocate for a reasoned tax structure that supports family agricultural operations in the state. We feel that our collaboration with the Oregon Law Commission and our partners in the agricultural sector, including our friends at the Farm Bureau, accomplished these goals with the intent of seeking a tax credit that maximizes resource utilization and minimizes the fiscal impact. And that's all I have, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I'll ask you to comment, and you may not be prepared at this level of detail, but to comment on the same thing, the switch from working capital to a set percentage of the estate, how that would affect your members.
And Chair Burdick, you're correct. I, at this point, wouldn't be able to give you an in-depth answer on that, and perhaps someone would be able to.
Yeah. I'm just trying to get, because we have such a diverse natural resources industry, I just want to make sure that that's something, and I know that the Law Commission looked into this very thoroughly, but we always like to hear from people who are on the ground.
Certainly.
And Senator Burdick, I'll just add that, you know, you make a good point with the diversity. 20% for a wheat grower may be insufficient. 20% for a nursery may be insufficient, but 20% for a grass seed grower, maybe. I have no way to really gauge that from commodity to commodity. From the Farm Bureau's perspective, we're general ag. We try to find a solution that works for the agricultural community, regardless of what you grow. Is there going to be winners and losers in that modification? Of course. But I think that that 20% provision is a reasonable solution that does provide a finite amount and that ease of accounting at the time of disbursement for the practitioners and for the department. So that's our perspective.
Okay, thanks. Thank you. That's helpful. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Pauline and Richard Mather. Do we have Pauline and Richard here? Okay, well, if they come in, we'll call them up. Peggy Woolsey.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and esteemed committee. My name is Peggy Woolsey. I am the retired inheritance tax auditor for 2 years now. Before that, I worked at the Department of Revenue for 31 and a half years. I started there in 1977 as a clerk in the inheritance tax files. We had about 12 inheritance tax auditors, and only three of them were junior auditors. The rest of them were senior auditors. We had a tax that was based on who inherited. People with a closer relationship to the decedent paid less percentage than people who were collateral relatives or non-related. And that's the difference between inheritance tax and estate tax. Estate tax is just the estate in full, regardless of who inherits. And so the other question I wanted to answer for you is anecdotal. In the years that I was the inheritance tax auditor, I saw one case that was clearly a situation where somebody moved to Washington in anticipation of death. It was a very large estate. Upon learning that the decedent was terminal, there was a decision to sell off huge amounts of assets, and in anticipation of the sale, they moved there not to save on inheritance tax, because they would have to pay more in Washington, but to save on income tax, which was a bigger issue at that point. And so overall, I thought the committee did a wonderful job in bringing together a variety of opposing and maybe contrasting interests, a wonderful job of talking out each issue all the way around. Sometimes we'd start out at one position, we'd talk around to the opposite, and then talk around ourselves back.
The Law Commission?
The Law Commission, yes, I'm sorry. At the Law Commission, we would sometimes go full circle on talking around the issues. They did a wonderful job in clarifying a lot of the law that's almost impossible to interpret now because it's so obtuse. They did a wonderful job in bringing those diverse interests together and coming to consensus. The one position that we in Tax Fairness Oregon might take a different position on would be the advocacy for the $1.5 million threshold. We advocate a $1 million threshold, but that's the only place where I can see a real diverse opinion.
Well, that's good to know.
Any questions?
Any questions from the committee?
Okay.
Thank you very much. Is there anybody out there who has anything negative to say about the Law Commission? Okay. All right. I'm going to give Pauline and Richard Mather another chance to come forward if they've come in the room. They are not here. Mr. Shetterly, have you heard anything that would make you want to have any response? You're on your way, so you might as well come.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Really only to thank Peggy Woolsey. She was an invaluable member of the work group, having been an auditor and having actually worked with this in so many estates. So Peggy's participation was just great. I'm disappointed she's not entirely on board with the $1.5 million. But again, we knew that was a policy choice that we'd be presenting. Peggy's just an example of the quality of people that we had on the work group with us.
Appreciate that. And at some point, it would be nice to round up everyone who is on this committee and bring them forward.
Thank you, Manager. I would invite them maybe next time we have this in bill form. Yeah.
Yes, and as we anticipate, there is a similar bill in the House, and we will probably see the House bill. Right. But I think it's really important that you're willing to take the time to keep us up to speed, because the way things crank along around here, we may not have all the time we would want after it gets
here. Yeah, my pleasure.
So thank you. Any other parting questions? Anybody have anything bad to say? All right.
Thank you again.
Okay, that concludes our meeting. Is there anybody else in the audience who wanted to say anything? Okay, that concludes our meeting today, and we are adjourned. Adjourned.